Hello, my name is Tapio Museba, and this is the Commercial Awareness Podcast, episode 70. First, some headlines. In an update to Apple and Epic's battle, Apple has said that it will cut its App Store tax in half to 15% for small developers with less than $1 million in annual net sales, which won't help Epic, but will definitely help a majority of developers on the App Store. Next, in food and hospitality consolidation news, Inspire Brands, owner of American food outlets such as Arby's and Buffalo Wild Wings, has agreed to acquire Dunkin' Brands, owner of Dunkin' Donuts and Baskin-Robbins, in a deal that values Dunkin' at $11.3 billion. Paul, Weiss, Rifkind, Wharton & Garrison is advising Inspire, and Ropes & Gray is advising Dunkin'. In news media consolidation news, BuzzFeed is acquiring news website HuffPost from Verizon Media, in a deal which involves Verizon becoming a minority shareholder in BuzzFeed, and the two companies agreeing to collaborate on advertising and other monetization opportunities. In an attempt to improve trainee development during the pandemic, Evershed Sutherland has created a virtual shadowing project that allows junior lawyers to attend virtual meetings between partners and clients, followed by a debrief with the partner. In brick-and-mortar retail, Housing Secretary Robert Jenrick has said that in the run-up to Christmas, local authorities will be able to waive retail opening hours rules, permitting retailers to stay open for 24 hours. Primark is one retailer that has announced it will be taking advantage of this rule easing when the lockdown is lifted on Wednesday. And finally, it was just announced that Arcadia Group, owner of clothing retailers Topshop, Burton, and Dorothy Perkins, has entered into administration, putting 13,000 jobs at risk. Deloitte has been appointed as administrator, and Freshfields will be acting for them. If you'd like to read more on any of these headlines, links, as always, are in the description. The format for this episode is two longer reads. For the first read, the world's largest hotelier, Marriott International, has been fined $18.4 million for a data breach by the Information Commissioner's Office. To begin, we've spoken about data breaches before. As recent as the headlines of episode 68, we mentioned that the Information Commissioner's Office fined British Airways a record fine of £20 million after initially announcing an intention to issue a £183 million fine for a data breach that affected 400,000 customers. Before then was the EasyJet data breach in episode 54, and before that was the Travelex scandal in episode 35. And generally, what's nice about mentioning stories in the same category is that we kind of already have a roadmap about what happened and why it matters. When it comes to data breaches, we often report the scale, how many people have been affected, any GDPR issues, have they followed the rules when it comes to reporting, and then we mention the reputational and financial damage that comes with a data breach, and why it's important for companies to report to the data protection and security arms of the firms that advise them as soon as a breach is found. And so, we'll do that here. How many people were affected? For British Airways, it was 400,000 customers. For EasyJet, it was 9 million. As the ICO reports it, the breach in question today affected 339 million customers worldwide, 7 million in the UK. Much larger scale. Any GDPR issues? Well, at the time, it seemed as if the breach was only reported 2 months after being discovered. GDPR requires a company to notify the ICO of a data breach within 72 hours, and if it does not, the company must keep its own record and be ready to explain why. But it seems the news reporting was later than the reporting to the ICO, as the ICO in the penalty notice mentioned that, quote, Marriott acted promptly to contact customers and the ICO. End quote. And other than that, one can only imagine that a company in hospitality would have probably preferred not being fined for anything during a time when hotel use is at an all-time low. But considering the scale of the breach and being fined less than British Airways for a breach that affected more than 17 times the amount of customers in the UK alone, they may feel a bit fortunate. And to take it a step further, one can also imagine that companies are investing into stronger data protection and cyber insurance, especially as employees across industries work from home. Now more than ever, data breaches are probably easier than they've ever been. So who knows, a potential value-added service firms can provide to their clients as general work-from-home safety tips from the data protection team. Why am I giving out free ideas? and we could be done with the story there. But that's no fun. This story actually isn't your average paint-by-numbers data breach. I've omitted some rather interesting details about this breach so far. The breach actually occurred with one of Marriott International's subsidiaries, Starwood Hotels and Resorts. Starwood itself was quite a large hotel group, owning chains such as Westin, W Hotels, Sheraton, and Le Méridien. Marriott acquired Starwood in 2016 in a deal valuing the target at $13.6 billion, and the acquisition made Marriott International the world's largest hotel group. And maybe you already know where I'm going with this. Turns out, the cyber attack to Starwood began in 2014, long before the acquisition, and remained undetected until late 2018, 2 years after the acquisition was completed. That means Starwood's data was breached, exposed millions of customers' personal data, including their unencrypted passport numbers, for 4 years, and in that time, a buyer came in, performed due diligence because of caveat emptor, completed the acquisition, and only 2 years after that, found the data breach. So, who's to blame? It seems the ICO didn't need to be asked twice. The ICO's investigation found that, quote, Marriott failed to undertake sufficient due diligence when it bought Starwood, and should also have done more to secure its systems, end quote. And that's all well and good to say now, with hindsight being 2020, but how do you find something you don't know you're looking for? What I'm trying to say is, the ICO has pointed out poor due diligence, but on whose part? Financial due diligence involves an accountant looking at the target company's financial records, including its earnings, capital, trends, and forecasts. Legal due diligence involves the buyer company's lawyers looking at the legal documentation of the target and looking for any legal problems or concerns. Any missing titles for property, any pending litigation, employment contracts, supply contracts. So whose job is it to perform a forensic analysis of the target company's data? And would a target company agree to giving a buyer complete access to over 300 million customers? And would the GDPR even allow such a data sharing process? For the last two questions, it's probably a no. It seems the GDPR, in terms of legal due diligence, is more interested in the personal data that's shared in data rooms, and not necessarily about the discovery of data breaches. So does that mean we've pointed out a blind spot in due diligence? Well, potentially. I assume some specialized buyers, such as tech companies, would require some sort of third-party forensic analysis of a target company's data as a condition precedent to completion. A target company in that scenario may agree to such a detailed due diligence, and the parties could sign confidentiality agreements as per. But if not, what else can a lawyer provide? First, a lawyer can encourage their client to get cyber insurance, which at least financially protects the company from any data breaches. Other than that, during the drafting of the share purchase agreement, the buyer's lawyers can request that the target warrants that they are not aware of any data breaches that would harm the financial output or reputation of the company. But that wouldn't really protect the buyer in this scenario, as it seems Starwood genuinely wasn't aware, and neither was Marriott until 2 years later. The solution, therefore, may be earn-out clauses reliant on good data security and no legacy breaches that are found within a reasonable time period post-completion, say 3 to 5 years. An earn-out clause is commonly used where part of the purchase price will only be paid to the seller if the company meets certain financial goals. This is to protect the buyer a bit, as it incentivizes the seller to be accurate about the company's financial performance and outlook. But like I said, this is usually for financial performance, so it would need some sort of modification to be used in relation to data breaches. Of course, a target company wouldn't really want to be on the hook for a long period of time post-completion, so this solution would probably result in a very lucrative earnout clause to entice the target, which is more expensive for the buyer, but on the plus side, it would encourage good data security across the board if it became popular. And that, in my opinion, was the far more interesting element of this story. That this story exposes a potential due diligence blind spot. And beyond that, this entire story highlights just how important good cybersecurity is for so many industries these days. It's no longer just for your lawyers, accountants, banks, and tech companies. Think about just how many companies have, at a bare minimum, your name and email address. The GDPR requires those companies to protect your personal data, and if they fail, they face financial and reputational consequences. But having said that, reputational consequences for Marriott, the world's largest hotel group. Maybe? Or when it's all right to travel again, you'll inadvertently find yourself in one of the hotels they own. And financial consequences? $20 billion turnover last year, £18.3 million fine. It's definitely not nothing, to be fair, but you might be wondering why it was so low. First, though the breach began in 2014, the ICO only considered the breach from the 25th of May 2018, which is when GDPR came into effect. Therefore, the fine only reflects a 4-month breach as opposed to a 4-year breach. Do with that what you will. It's also worth noting that the ICO took the lead for all EU authorities over this fine under the GDPR, as the breach occurred before Brexit. Next, after the ICO filed the notices of an intention to fine those much larger figures, they published a proposed statutory guidance on enforcement, which generally set a higher maximum amount of 20 million euros. So it's still a fine, but it may affect companies with smaller turnovers far more if the implied cap of 20 million euros or pounds after December 31 remains. But one can imagine that the fines aren't meant to cripple the companies anyway, so you can understand the arguments for and against large penalties. Marriott, in response to the fine, said, quote, "Marriott does not intend to appeal the decision, but makes no admission of liability in relation to the decision or the underlying allegations. As the ICO acknowledges, Marriott cooperated fully throughout the investigation," end quote. Marriott is also facing a class action lawsuit in the UK and is facing an investigation in the US. So, that's the story. That's the apparent due diligence blind spot, plus the potential challenges and opportunities it presents for firms. And although the transition period ends on the 31st, the UK government has announced that GDPR, quote, "will be retained in UK law and will continue to be read alongside the Data Protection Act 2018, end quote, which is nice. In closing, the questions I have for you are, first, what's the solution for this due diligence blind spot? Mutual liability for any data breaches between buyer and seller post-completion? Indemnity? Or should cyber due diligence become commonplace? I know the Big Four has some cybersecurity capability, but there can still be room for lawyers in this new frontier of due diligence. If making cyber due diligence commonplace is the solution, though no lawyer can be expected to be an expert at that, they could still assist in advising clients for year-on-year security reviews, safeguards, and internal audits of security systems. Second question, how do you feel about the fines? Were these correct or incorrect? Why? What should the purpose of the fines be? And finally, post-transition period and in the long term, should the UK make data protection more stringent, more lenient, or keep it exactly the same? Credit for this story goes to James Fontanella Khan, Arash Masudi, Madhumita Murgia, the Information Commissioner's Office, PwC, Marriott International, and Ed Hayes. Next, and finally, let us talk about Subway bread not actually being bread, according to the Supreme Court in Ireland. This story made waves on social media for just how bizarre the headline was. But beneath the surface is actually an interesting showcase of a few commercial awareness considerations, and that surrounds franchising and VAT, or VAT, or value-added tax. Let's talk about franchising first. For many retailers, restaurants, and takeaways like Subway, the expansion model of choice is franchising. This model has resulted in over 2,500 Subway locations in the UK and Ireland alone. That is to allow a third party, known as a franchisee, to use the main company or franchisor's branding or IP to launch and sell the franchisor's products at a new location, and in return, the franchisor is paid some sort of flat initial fee, then a year-on-year percentage on sales and royalties for using that IP. It has pros and cons for both parties involved, as you can imagine. For the franchisor, it allows them to expand without needing much capital, and they do not need to have sole responsibility of the day-to-day running of the franchises. However, the lack of sole responsibility and control of each franchise also opens the franchisor up to a diminishing of the brand's value or reputation if a franchise performs poorly, for example, and so, some sort of oversight and quality control is necessary. For a franchisee, it allows them to start a new business with sort of a head start. By being allowed to use the goodwill and brand recognition of a well-known company, part of the job is already done, and the franchise's business model is somewhat tried and tested. I say somewhat because there is still a risk to starting a business in a new market. Further cons are, of course, the high initial investment that comes with buying franchising rights and having to find and sometimes construct the restaurant site, the lack of full control considering you're adopting a business model. Subway in this case picks the franchisee's suppliers and does not allow a franchisee to find new ones to maintain quality. And because franchise agreements are not eternal, considering a franchise agreement for Subway is 20 years initially, after those 20 years, the franchisor could choose not to renew, leaving a franchisee's business high and dry. To apply to Subway even further, on their Subway franchising website, from a UK context, though the initial franchise fee is £8,500, the company also estimates that the total initial investment could range from £85,000 to £220,000. Then the franchisor expects a fee of about 8% of the franchise's net sales each year, and also expects a franchisee to spend 4.5% of the company's net sales on marketing. Keep in mind that's on net sales, not profits. If a franchisee is loss-making, the franchisor still gets the percentage of sales. After franchising, the other important piece of the puzzle to understand today is VAT, or value-added tax. It's a consumption or consumer-based tax, which involves the taxing of the supply of products and services across the production, distribution, and sale of those products and services. That doesn't explain much, though, does it? To break it down, let's start with the tangible part. We all have first-hand experience with VAT as consumers. It's included in the invoice of the goods we purchase. In the UK, VAT standard rate is 20%. But it's important to know that in this setup, the businesses we buy from are also consumers at some point in their production line, and they too have to pay VAT in these scenarios. For those businesses, the VAT they have to pay to other vendors for their raw materials, or even to accountants and lawyers for professional services, is called input tax. The VAT they charge to us, the consumer, for a sale is called output tax. And so, every 3 months in the UK, the company must file a VAT return form to HMRC, where they detail how much VAT they've paid to other businesses, input tax, and how much VAT they've collected from their own customers, output tax. If a company has paid more VAT to other businesses than they've charged their customers, HMRC will refund the company the difference. However, if a company has charged more VAT than they've paid to other vendors, they must pay that difference to HMRC. Therefore, a company that wants to pay as little tax as possible, and in fact wants the largest refund as possible from HMRC, wants to sell items subject to the lowest amount of VAT. In the UK, there are three rates of VAT. The standard rate is 20%, the reduced rate is 5%, and some items are zero-rated. Most items are chargeable at 20%, which is why we regularly see it in our invoices. The reduced rate is for a select number of items. The exhaustive list is on Schedule 7A of the Value-Added Tax Act of 1994, but this includes children's car seats, domestic fuel, and power. And the zero rating means that the selling of the goods or services still has to be listed in a VAT return, but the output tax will be charged at 0% for those goods. Schedule 8 of the same act has the list of what is zero rated, and this includes what you can class as essential goods, such as food, water, transport, clothing, and footwear. And I know what you might be thinking. I'm pretty sure the last time I bought food somewhere, I paid VAT. And you're right. Though food is technically zero rated, the VAT Act and the VAT notices that have followed it list all the times the zero rating does not apply, And it gets oddly specific, and to be honest, the reading I had to do for this whole story has made me gain a newfound respect for tax lawyers. To illustrate, though Schedule 8 mentions that, quote, food of a kind used for human consumption, end quote, is zero-rated, this does not apply to, quote, food supplied in the course of catering, end quote, which is standard-rated. The reasoning is, VAT shouldn't be charged for necessities. Though food is a necessity, it is not a necessity to eat at a restaurant or hot takeaway. VAT Notice 70114 has a rather illustrative list of when food is food and when it is standard rated or zero rated. It's worth a read and it's in the description, but to provide an example of how specific this notice is, yogurt that has been frozen for ease of distribution but must be thawed before you eat it is zero rated, but frozen yogurt, or froyo, is standard rated. That's in paragraph 3.5 of the VAT notice, which states that any food that must be eaten while frozen is standard rated, but food that must be thawed for consumption is zero rated. The VAT notice in paragraph 3.4 mentions bakery products, and though baked products such as bread, biscuits, and cakes are zero rated, as you can guess, there are exceptions to this. One of those exceptions is, biscuits covered wholly or partly in chocolate are standard rated. But that's biscuits. A cake covered in chocolate is zero rated, which led to the iconic case in 1991 before the tax tribunal to answer the age-old question, are Jaffa cakes cakes or biscuits? McVitie's had enjoyed a zero rating for the Jaffa cake since its inception in 1927, but this was challenged in 1991 by HMRC, and McVitie's had to argue once again that Jaffa cakes are indeed cakes. The tribunal ruled that Jaffa cakes are cakes, not biscuits, for VAT purposes at least. Though you find Jaffa cakes in the biscuits section of a supermarket, and its packaging is similar to that of a biscuit, its ingredients are that of a sponge cake. And similar to a cake, a Jaffa cake is moist and hardens when stale, as opposed to a biscuit, which softens when it's stale. And these were arguments that McVitie's solicitors had to research and draft and instruct a barrister to argue before the tribunal. And they were successful. Jaffa cakes remain cakes to this day. But speaking of bakery products, paragraph 3.40 rates bread, and bread products such as rolls and baps, unless they are supplied as part of a hot takeaway meal. Emphasis on hot. Cold takeaway food is zero rated. This has actually been a point of contention for Subway franchisees in the UK. Subway franchisees in the past have taken issue with how sandwich stores like Pret, for example, can sell toasted and cold sandwiches that are zero rated, but Subway sandwiches are standard rated. They brought a claim against HMRC in 2010 in the first tier tribunal, and eventually in the Court of Appeal, and lost. The franchisees, about 1,200 in the UK, took issue with what it meant for food to be hot, and claimed that Subway sandwiches are not hot. The food must be hot at the time it's provided to the customer, and hot means, quote, above ambient air temperature, end quote. The tribunals, and ultimately the Court of Appeal, paid attention to the toasting of the subs from Subway, which would place it above ambient air temperature, and specifically the meatball marinara sub was considered, which cannot be served cold, or else the sauce would not be palatable. They also applied a test over what the so-called nature of the deal was between the consumer and Subway for a hot sandwich. And because the deal was the consumer wants their sandwich toasted so it is hot, the food being heated to order therefore definitely does not make it cold takeaway food. The claimants also tried to rely on an EU law principle called fiscal neutrality, which, like the name implies, is meant to prevent the discriminatory taxing of similar products to distort competition. The deliberation over this point is quite long-ranging, but in short, the courts decided that though there were EU tax directives based on harmonization, it was still on each member state to draw their own line between what is zero-rated and standard-rated, so long as it is, quote, for clearly defined social reasons and for the benefit of the final consumer, end quote. Of course, this point is moot after the 31st of December. Brexit is still happening, in case you forgot. But it's not the last time we'll hear about fiscal neutrality. Anyway, today, VAT Notice 7091 includes a number of tests to clarify when food is standard rated, and one of the tests, food or drink that's been heated to order, now names, quote, toasted bread, sandwiches, and paninis, end quote. And because of this, Subway generally charges more for the hot subs. That's a VAT issue. Want your sandwich toasted? That puts the sandwich above ambient air temperature, therefore, VAT is charged there too. In fact, one loophole, if you can call it that, is what some takeaways sell as heat-at-home items, like Pret. Food sold from takeaways that require some sort of preparation by the customer is also zero-rated, as this is no longer sold in the course of catering by the seller. Another interesting technicality to take notice of is, the cold takeaway food is zero-rated, but if you consume that same cold food on the premises, it's standard-rated. Probably part of the reason some places charge more for eating in, because you've increased their tax liability. Like Pret. The VAT notices are updated relatively often, and it's worth noting at this juncture that currently, all food supplied and sold in the course of catering that is normally subject to the standard rate of 20% is now subject to a reduced 5% rate in the UK from the 15th of July until the 12th of January next year, assumedly to bolster the VAT refunds for these restaurants and takeaways, and potentially lower the prices of their food for customers, at the restaurants and takeaways' discretion, of course. So, if you notice that some of your takeaways lower their prices over the summer and the prices have remained lower, it's probably to reflect this VAT cut. If your favorite takeaways' prices remain the same, well, you know, times are tough and having to print new prices and menus is expensive. All of that to say, tax law is far more interesting than I initially thought, and reading these VAT notices really lets you put things into perspective as a consumer. And from a pseudo-sociological perspective, it also allows you to see what certain countries deem essential and therefore zero-rated, and what they consider indulgences and therefore standard-rated or with a reduced rate. So, we've spoken a little about the VAT system in the UK, so now let's talk about Ireland, and what Subway's franchisees got up to there. The case in question is an Irish Supreme Court decision over an appeal by an Irish Subway franchisee, Bookfinders, over VAT. VAT in Ireland is governed by the VAT Act of 1972, and Ireland also has three tiers of tax. The standard rate is 21%, the reduced rate is 13.5%, and there's the zero rate. Food and drink is zero rated, but the exceptions are a little different. For one, all bakery products are excluded from the zero rating except bread. Because of this narrow exclusion, the Act also includes a rather specific definition of what bread is. Bread is, according to Schedule 2 of the Act, quote, food for human consumption manufactured by baking dough composed exclusively of a mixture of cereal flour and any one or more of the ingredients, end quote, mentioned in subclauses subject to limitations in relation to the weight of the flour and the dough, specified for each ingredient. For our purposes, the bread dough cannot contain sugar that exceeds 2% of the weight of the flour. It's also worth noting that there is no specific mention of takeaways in restaurants and the like, but functionally, hot takeaways are subject to a reduced rate of 13.5%. As it says in the statute, any food and drink that has been heated, quote, enabling it to be consumed at a temperature above the ambient air temperature, end quote, is subject to the reduced rate of 13.5%. So if you're keeping track, to compare the VAT in Ireland to the UK, while hot takeaways in the UK are standard rated, it is a reduced rate in Ireland. Now, with that established, what was Bookfinder's actual case here? It was a little pedantic, to be honest. This was a long but entertaining read. Their first argument was that, because the Act says, quote, the supply of food and drink, end quote, when mentioning the reduced rate, this should be read conjunctively, not disjunctively. Meaning, their argument was that, only when food and drink are supplied at the same time would they be subject to the 13.5% VAT. Otherwise, it should be zero rated. The judge, reading the statute with the purposive interpretation, found that argument to be less than convincing and ruled against it. Second, the infamous bread. In the judgment, it's expressly stated that, quote, there is no dispute that the bread supplied by Subway and its heated sandwiches has a sugar content of 10% of the weight of the flour included in the dough, and thus exceeds the 2%, end quote, specified in Schedule 2 of the Act. So, if there's no dispute, what was all of this about? Their argument here was also quite pedantic. Quite a lot of mental, legal, and literary gymnastics here. To understand their argument, I have to read out the entire definition to you again in case you forgot it, so you too can witness the audacity. So, from the judgment, I'm going to read Schedule 2, Paragraph 7, Subsection D2, then Subsection 2 below that. Here goes. Quote, in this subparagraph, bread means food for human consumption manufactured by baking dough composed exclusively a mixture of cereal flour and any one or more of the ingredients mentioned in the following subclauses in quantities not exceeding the limitation, if any, specified for each ingredient, fat, sugar, and bread improver, subject to the limitation that the weight of any ingredient specified in the subclause shall not exceed 2% of the weight of flour included in the dough, end quote. I hope you're still with me. So, you know the phrase, quote, specified for each ingredient, end quote. Their argument was, because the word is each and not any, the statute should be read to mean that the thing you make is only no longer bread if each or every single one of the extra ingredients exceeded the limitations. Meaning, because Subway only exceeded one, it should still be bread because they didn't also exceed the limitations on fat and bread improver, for example. As you can imagine, this argument was also dismissed. Third, fiscal neutrality was mentioned. But this time, not even with providing evidence that other takeaways like Pret's sell toasted sandwiches that are zero-rated. Instead, the claimant here argued that the exclusion of their bread from the bread definition was a breach of fiscal neutrality. Because fiscal neutrality required a distortion of competition, the lack of evidence was quite damning, and though the claimant then asked the court to consider a hypothetical toasted sandwich sold in another outlet, the court dismissed that request, also highlighting that regardless of the bread, the sandwich being heated cannot be zero-rated. So the appeal was dismissed, and that's the story. Subway bread isn't bread, at least in Ireland. So with all that said, why does this matter? For starters, welcome to the world of tax and particularly VAT litigation, and how specific it gets. If we're keeping track, I'd probably say that the Irish case was more of a long shot compared to the UK case. Regardless, it caught everyone's attention and allowed us to talk a little more about VAT and its interesting application in our daily lives. And comparing systems as we did also illustrates why firms have offices in multiple jurisdictions to better serve international clients, to be best placed in advising them over their tax liability from country to country. And I know that fiscal neutrality is quite moot considering 31 December is right around the corner, but it does ask interesting questions. How do you generally feel about the distinction between heated-to-order food and cold takeaways? Is that a fair VAT distinction or not? And in answering that, think about potentially why that distinction may have been a good idea to begin with, and whether such a distinction is still valid. And if it isn't valid, would you make both standard rated, or both zero rated, or somewhere in between as it's done in Ireland? I'm aware that this story was very specific, and you might be thinking, do I really have to know the entire schedule of what is zero rated and what isn't? I don't think so, but from my experience, if you mention a term, you should probably know what that thing is and how it works. So if you mention VAT, knowing how it works with input and output will hopefully be enough. And the other point I wanted to make was one about the risks of franchising that these cases highlight. In fact, the UK case, the claimant franchisee, Sub 1, brought the claim in liquidation, accusing HMRC for unfairly taxing its products and therefore contributing to its demise. And though that case also could have been a long shot to recover some sort of money, it also demonstrates the benefit of tax lawyers from start to finish for any franchisee and franchisor. So both parties know the tax liability any looming VAT changes, and how best to respond. I'm sure that even with the VAT cut the UK currently has, some clients were calling their lawyers, asking for clarification over what they're legally obliged to do as a result of this, and what it means for their VAT liability. And beyond that, it also highlights that even with the tried and tested business model and well-known brand, franchises can fail, so that's something that needs to be said to clients considering franchising. So I hope this story makes you a little more curious about what is and what isn't standard rated in our day-to-day. And who knows, instead of a YouTube rabbit hole tonight, you'll be able to tell your friends, did you know that the sweet treat, Scottish snowballs, are zero rated, but Swedish snowballs are standard rated? Or maybe don't say that out loud to your friends, but you and I, we'll know. We'll know. Credit for this story goes to Sam Jones, Helen Sullivan, Irish Supreme Court, England and Wales Court of Appeal, and the gov.uk website. This has been the Commercial Awareness Podcast. Please be sure to follow, subscribe, and rate the podcast on your listening platform. It goes a long way. Also, recommend it to a friend. If you need to contact me, the podcast email address is on the first line of the episode description, and the podcast Instagram page is at ComAwarePod, that is ComAwarePod, if you prefer to contact me there or just want to follow the podcast there for any updates. The podcast Instagram page is also a way to interact with the podcast where you can participate in polls to reflect on past episodes and suggest topics for future episodes. Other than that, thank you for listening, and you'll hear from me next week. So, announcement as to why the release schedule has been intermittent, to put it kindly. Well, I've gotten a little busier. I started a doctorate in a field of law I've had a large academic interest in for quite a while. In case you didn't know, a PhD is actually a lot of work and a huge time commitment. Who would have thought? So balancing the plates has been a little difficult as of late, but as I get the hang of things, I'm sure we'll get back to some normalcy. I don't know if you know this or not, but for the past 70 episodes, I have pretty much been doing all of this alone. The research, the writing, the recording, the editing, the uploading, the socials. Why have I been doing that? The same reason I still do it. I enjoy sharing stories I find interesting with you and enjoy helping you towards your career aspirations. So not only do I thank you for listening, I thank you for letting me be a small, minuscule part of your journey by listening. And of course, thank you for your patience throughout this period. Is there a chance the podcast will come to an end? No, I enjoy doing it too much. But you may have to be patient with me for a little while longer, as I'll be the first to admit that though the plates haven't fallen and broken yet, it's still a little wobbly. And if you'd like some BTS, as in behind the scenes, not the K-pop group, this episode in particular took quite a while because the subway story involved quite a lot of case reading, which I hadn't done in quite a while, and that's kind of what I like about doing the podcast. It lets me showcase all these new practice areas and sectors and keeps my own commercial awareness research fresh. So I hope you did enjoy that story, and I hope you've been enjoying the podcast in the midst of all the delays. I've also brought on two volunteers, and hopefully you'll be seeing their contributions in the coming weeks. In short, I'm not going anywhere, but for now, it may be a bit irregular, and I hope you'll be here to listen when the episodes do come out. Thank you for listening, for your 5-star ratings, your messages, and you'll hear from me soon.